Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I'm the editor of the TLS. Thea Leonarduzzi is here. We're ready to go. I just mentioned something about the shriek of discontent being lessened, if only for a second.
And in that spirit,
we are approaching this podcast. My whole family had Noro this week.
I'm sorry.
So that's three children, both parents. Yeah. And I have felt off food.
Really?
You know me, yeah. My relationship with food is troubling at the best of times. Yeah. I would take the pill.
You have a functional relationship.
Yeah,
with food.
You would never take the pill, would you?
No.
I would take the pill. And God, I would take the pill now.
Yeah.
I think more than ever now, there's no food I want to eat.
Well, I think the general rule with, because I was ill over Christmas and completely went off food, and the general rule with anything, as far as I go with it anyway, is eat whatever you want, as much of it as you want.
And just don't even think about it.
Don't even think about it. I just had a crunchy just because I wasn't really hungry and I thought, well, that'll do.
How
it's really depressing, but I'm now high on sugar.
Yeah, was the crunchy did that feel good?
It was very nostalgic.
Yeah, well, it's a little Madeline moment.
Just anything, yeah, exactly, anything that you fancy.
Am I allowed pasta and Marmite?
You probably are. I mean, a staple for me when I'm ill is pasta with pasta in bianco, so it's white. Pasta in the white, white pasta.
And what
just
is
pasta
it?
Pasta with butter, basically.
And salt and pepper?
Yeah, a bit cheese? Of salt and pepper, if you're feeling bold.
Yeah, parmesan?
Well, I mean, cheese isn't going to help a kind of a troubled digestive system.
No, it'd be nicer.
But if you fancy it, if you feel you can have it, then
my mum used to say a little bit of what you fancy does you good.
Exactly, exactly.
That feels like an Italian proverb.
Must be.
All right, I feel better now. The shriek of discontent has got even less in my head.
Have a crunchy. Go
have
all out.
Have a crunchy. Everyone.
Sponsored by Crunchy.
Yeah, sit back, enjoy this podcast, have a crunchy. Here's the bit where I not only encourage you to eat chocolate, but also to subscribe to the TLS. Use this special offer code and get on board the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. That's the best price anywhere on the internet. 5 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up this week, we have a design special of the newly designed TLS, looking at all sorts of aspects around how things are rendered fit for purpose. Keith Miller will be here to tell us about Charlotte Perriand, as Thea would exuberantly say, the designer who lived for almost the whole 20th century. Why does she matter? Stanley Donwood is an artist, author and designer of album covers, including for Radiohead. He advocates for this most democratic of artworks. And did Byron have an eating disorder? And should we care? Emily A. Bernhard Jackson has the answers. And I love Byron anyway, so why not talk about him for a bit? Byron's Don Juan is full of relish about consumption of wine and feasts and so on, but occasionally something more sinister. So Juan's spaniel, spite of his entreating, was killed and portioned out for present eating. Things get worse during a bad time on a boat. Part was divided, part thrown in the sea, and such things as the entrails and the brains regaled two sharks who followed o'er the billow. The sailors ate the rest of poor Pedrillo. It's not really relevant, but I wanted to read it out anyway, and it's almost relevant, as this week Emily A. Bernhard-Jackson has reviewed a new book called The Private Life of Lord Byron by Anthony Peattie, which argues that all of Byron's works can be explained as the result of one overarching mental problem, his disordered eating, or maybe one or two others as well. Emily's here to explain more. Emily, hello.
Hello.
Before we start talking about that, your first paragraph tells us of your fantasy of romantic poets in therapy.
Well, someone's fantasy, but
so the idea. Yes. So the idea is that Keats could have, if he'd been properly counselled, could have left off Fanny Brawne.
Well, he could have not written her those what I find to be very disturbing letters.
Yeah, well, they are disturbing, aren't they?
I think all of them. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why, in the modern day, there's often a sense that poets need to be crazy.
Yeah.
I think that this first begins with the Romantics, all of whom in different ways, I would say, yeah, could have done with some therapy.
But there's an argument which I think you're resisting here, which the book doesn't resist, is that Byron, in all his wondrous eccentric glory, can be reduced to what amounts to a pathology. Do you disagree with that in principle, that he must be more than a pathological explanation for him?
Yeah, I do disagree with that. I disagree with it because I don't think anybody can be reduced to a pathological explanation. And I think that, again, something that often sort of slips out of the mind when talking about authors is that, after all, they are just people. They eat lunch, put on their socks. I think there is a kind of tendency for readers to forget the way in which what we're reading was produced just by a person. And I think Byron,
particularly with Byron, is because he's so lionized.
Yes.
And
yeah. But he was so strange, and I was going to say so determinedly strange, but I'm not sure that's true. But he was so odd that I think there is a desire to reduce him. He must be explicable by one or two things, but I don't think he was. I don't think anyone is.
What of the oddness? What kind of oddness, just to refresh our memories?
He was possibly manic depressive. He was certainly depressive. And he might have been manic. It's retrospective diagnosis is always risky, I think. He both loved and disliked people extremely.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly, the way in which he was strangest was that he had an affair with his half-sister.
Yeah.
What is strange about that is that he doesn't seem to have done it for any moral or immoral reason. That is, he liked his sister and wanted to sleep with her, and so he did.
Yeah.
And whereas I think the majority of people would wrestle to some degree with the morality of that, he doesn't seem to have done that, at least before he slept with her.
And he was horrible to his wife, really, wasn't he? I mean,
yeah, he was. He was horrible to his wife. He was not a nice man.
Really? And yet in some respects, possibly he was. You
yes.
Because he goes off to fight in Greece and he adopts a Muslim girl at one point, I think, and pays for it, and he spends a lot of money looking after. There seems to be a generosity to him in some respects.
You know, I always say Byron liked peoples, but he didn't like people.
That's interesting.
And Lytton Strachey said that he didn't think that Byron was capable of having a real friend, that the kind of connection and sense of equality that a friendship requires, Byron simply couldn't manage. And I think that's true. He was very generous, but I don't think that he was a man who was made to be with other people for long amounts of time.
There's one story that when his wife was pregnant, he took a room beneath her bedroom and spent the night throwing bottles at the ceiling so she couldn't sleep. Is that not true?
That's not exactly true.
Go on.
He was in the living room
yeah.
while she was giving birth, so that makes it even worse.
Yeah.
But what he was actually doing was celebrating this fact with a friend by drinking mixed drinks, and he was knocking the top of seltzer bottles off with his cane. So he would go whack, and it would go pow, all over the place. Yes,
it's not.
Yes, while she was giving birth.
the book argues for these pathologies. Should we just what pathology? The main one is an eating disorder.
Yes, PG thinks that Byron had something that he calls heroic anorexia, which is essentially an anorexia that posits that control of the body is a kind of heroic act.
Is that his own coinage?
I believe so.
It sounds like a version of anorexia generally, which is the idea that it's a system of control rather than
highly offensive.
This is very complex, right? I mean, anorexia is commonly seen as a way of exerting power over yourself because you have no other kind of power. But yeah, there's something a little uncomfortable.
And do you? So his argument is that from there, a lot of other things flowed. Is that the argument?
Well, his idea is that Byron felt over maternalized by his mother, his hovering mother, and that kind of a way of gaining control over himself was this dieting, which was also a way of making himself less of a child. The difficulty, I should say, is that he makes this assertion a lot, but he is not very good at giving evidence.
And why can't that just be a symptom of a complex individual anyway, that Byron may have had many things going on in his life, of which one of them may well have been issues with food, which may well have a connection to certain control issues, but that's a tenth or a 50th of his personality. That seems more plausible,
doesn't it?
Yeah, I
think that's true. And I think the thing that Petey doesn't really take into account, which I think is more important, is that Byron was a fat little kid. And I think that if you have... And not a plump little kid. He was fat. And I think that once you have been fat in a world that prizes slenderness and you experience that difference, then you will do a lot to cling on to slenderness.
But what does that really have to do with Don Juan or any of the works? I only have Don Juan because I have it in my mind because I read it this year. But, you know, this is a piece of art, magnificently constructed, you know, a towering achievement of poetry. Do we need to draw a thick line in felt tip that says the man who created this had mummy issues?
And daddy issues.
And daddy issues. Yes. Sorry, Harold Bloom's why I don't like Harold, why I found Harold Bloom so annoying, which was that Keats had to be wrestling with Milton and wanted to strangle him. It's just everything seems like, that just seems like a very oversimplification of the complex web of human relationships.
Well, now you're asking me to take on the burden of every critic.
Let's go after Bloom for a bit. He can't respond.
Okay, so this is what I would say. I would say we are who we were. And that means that we are who we were when we were a child, and we are who we were last week, and we are who we were 2 minutes ago when we were eating a ham sandwich. And for that reason, I think that, yes, if you want to understand an author, that the author's selfhood must come into it. But I also think that if that were the case, then everyone would be a wildly successful author.
Yeah.
So there's something that great authors do, and I know that's a loaded term, but there's something that great authors do that ordinary people do not do. And so I would say...
I think we have to allow that term. I mean, I'm very conscious. I think I'm rather fond of notions of genius. People don't like it.
Me too.
But, you know, I think Shakespeare was a genius.
Probably, yeah. I mean, yes. I'm. You know what? Fine. I'm going to say yes. Yeah, I agree with you.
And I understand.
Transcendence.
Yeah, exactly. And when I first read Don Juan this year, I genuinely felt I was in the presence of just a greatness of mind.
Just a
cleverness. I love clever. I think cleverness is such a great thing. And look, he may have all sorts of character flaws, which we can, and I'm sure his biographies get into. But
well, first of all, yes, he was extremely clever. And I'm really, really glad that you think that because I think it too. However, in Don Juan specifically, there are all sorts of jabs, for example, at his wife.
Yeah.
So you can make an argument that people often do make, which is he brought it up. So now it has to be considered.
Well, he's the kind of modern, everyone says this is a cliche, but I'm sure it's probably true. One of the first, you know, I woke up in the morning and I was famous. He's a celebrity and he knew he was a celebrity. I mean, the other great thing about Don Juan is the pops at rival poets.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
Well, can I also say
Turdsworth?
He found himself extremely interesting.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that's extraordinary about Byron is that he really used himself as objective evidence to understand the self. And he was genuinely interested in that.
Yeah,
he did take a pop at a lot of other poets. He was what Samuel Johnson calls a good hater.
Yeah.
He really was.
It reminds me of rap, the beginning, the prologue to Don Juan, where he has a go at the late poets and he has a go at Bob Southey.
Southey.
Southey, and he says, you know, talks about him being a dry bob, which means sex without ejaculation. And it's a rap battle. It reminded me of, it's like 8 Mile. It's, you know, he sort of takes on his adversaries and he defeats them with his wit. So he's creating a public self to be poked at, isn't he?
He is. On the other hand, you could say a great poet does not take notice.
Well, that's maybe true.
Common other poets.
But maybe that's why we're so fascinated by him, why we want to talk about him, because he has a lot
of that and all the sex. That and,
yeah. But we don't know anything. We don't know anything about Shakespeare, really. Very little about him. We know some things, but not very. But Byron, we know a lot about, because there's sex and there's incest and there's
newspaper articles. Yeah, I mean, he. You know, we don't get a lot of poets who are on the front pages of newspapers anymore.
And he wanted that, do we think?
I think he wanted it, like a lot of celebrities, he wanted it until it was underway, and then he realized what a mistake it was. When he lived in Switzerland, people used to peer across the lake into his house with telescopes. And I don't really think anybody wants that when it's happening.
No. Did he need that? I mean,
certainly true.
Pathologizing? Are we sort of armchair, you know, psychoanalyzing him and saying this little fat, club-footed, possibly suppressed, well, not even possibly, you know.
Not little. He was actually, he was 5'8½", that's but lovely. Everybody was about 2 inches shorter.
Eight and a half is not little. It is by your standard.
Yeah, it's
little today,
yeah,
but you have to add it. No, he's not. He was 5'10".
Yeah.
And he didn't have a club foot. Everybody thinks he had a club foot, but he didn't have a club foot. He seems to have had a form of cerebral palsy.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
If you had something wrong with your leg or your foot in that period, they called it a club foot. But when you see his boots, he had to wear inner boots. If anybody wants to talk about Byron's pathology, they should really talk about his leg.
Yeah.
That, I mean, he had a terrible, as a child, they tried to twist it back into normal form. But when you see his inner boots, you can see that a club foot looks like a club.
Yeah.
And he didn't have that. He had a foot that curved inward and upward on the inside.
He's a man to whom myths attach, though.
Yes, he is. That's absolutely.
How about this for some pop psychology? If he lived in a society where he could have found love with another man easily, more easily, he would have been happier. The trajectory of his life would have been different. How much of what we're talking about here, for him, as for so many artists, actually, when you look at it, he was never allowed to express what he felt in that regard, and that must have had some sort of psychological impact upon him. Do we buy that as an argument?
To some degree. I don't think that Byron was gay.
But he had same-sex relationships.
That doesn't mean he was gay.
No, but I mean...
I don't even think he was bisexual. I think Byron had an understanding of sexuality that in... We love labels.
Yeah.
We love them. And I think Byron had an understanding of sexuality that defied labels.
But he had to write coded letters back from the Mediterranean about sexual...
He did. I'm not going to say that he didn't have sex with boys.
No.
He did have sex with boys.
And he had to conceal that and code it.
So do I think that he would have been happier if he'd been allowed to be the full person that he was? Yes, absolutely. Do I think he would have been happier if he'd been allowed to explore his full sexuality? Yes, absolutely.
But there's no point in labor.
It's not just that. I mean, I wonder then what might have happened. You know, Freud argues that art comes out of that kind of repression. So maybe he, like all the other romantics, as I suggest in the first paragraph, maybe he would have been a worse poet for it.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. I mean, he. I was going to say something that I actually, in the middle of saying it, I suddenly realized I didn't think was true.
Go on, say it anyway.
I was going to say, but it is not true.
Yes. Exactly.
That I don't think that he was interested in being very nice to people. But I don't think that's true. I think he was interested in being very nice to people.
But he just wasn't.
He just didn't manage.
He was sometimes. And he says this himself in his work, and I do think that this is true. I don't think that he had, you know, when you sort of go, who am I? You know, when you have those moments when you're like, who am I really? Am I this person? I think he might have asked himself that question, but I don't think that he had any self,
He didn't know the answer.
I don't think he knew the answer, and I'm not sure there was an answer.
Can we
and
say
is that,
that
in part because he had become such a celebrity, he kind of started to believe?
No, I just think that when I think of Byron, I think of someone who was in his work and in his journals, I imagine in his head, was an extremely honest man about everything except how unkind he could be to other people.
That's true of a lot of people, maybe.
Yeah, I think so.
Can we say, because this is a book that you've criticised fairly frankly, but it does allow us to have a conversation about Byron. It's good
yes,
on...
absolutely.
So the virtue of it is we're endlessly fascinated by Byron, as we've probably demonstrated in the last 20 minutes or so. it does enable us to get into who, I mean, we might not buy his theories, Petey, but he gets us into the Byron because he's good on the sources and...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do say that at the end of the review. I think that one thing that this book does that's just a huge boon to Byron studies is it makes it plain that we need a new scholarly biography of Byron. We have so many sources now about his same-sex relationships, about what he did politically in Italy. Roderick Beaton produced a book which makes all sorts of interesting arguments about what Byron was doing in the Greek Revolutionary War. And I feel that one thing that Petey does really well is the book essentially shows how much we need a new biography.
Or how much we regret the autobiography being consigned to the...
Yeah, well, that was very unfortunate.
Consigned to the... What was it? What was in it that was so bad?
Probably nothing.
Nothing, yeah. Lawyers.
Nothing much, yeah, that's the thing.
Lawyers and publishers.
And changing morals. We would probably just be like this.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine. Good luck to him. Yeah. Well, I love Byron. I love talking about Byron. I love reading your piece about Byron.
Me too. I'm so glad.
It's been a great joy. Emily, thank you so much for coming in.
Sure, my pleasure.
Stanley Donwood has a pretty hip CV as these things go. He's an artist who's created artwork for Radiohead with singer Tom York. He also works with Nature Wunderkind and one-time TLS fiction reviewer Rob McFarlane. This week in the TLS, he's made the case for the cultural value of album covers, which in the second half of the last century became, he argues, legitimate works of art themselves, and record shops perhaps the first genuinely democratic art galleries. It's a fine argument, and perhaps something of an elegy too. Most music now is consumed digitally, and so is the artwork, an assembly of ones and zeros that appears on a multiplicity of screens, sometimes as a tiny square on a Spotify page on an iPhone. How true. Stanley's here to look back in anger, perhaps a little, but also celebrate the humble album sleeve. Stanley, welcome.
Hi.
When and how do you think record covers became important? Because the fascinating thing about this piece, I hadn't thought about record covers in ages. Mm. And you sort of, you explained that they became important.
Well, I sort of deduced it. Well, some years ago, Radiohead went out to... Normally they record in these hideous, leaking, haunted hulks in the middle of nowhere. But this time we went to an actual recording studio in the south of France with sun and wine and everything nice.
And they actually, we actually had a piece in the TLS about it. The only interview they gave was in the TLS.
Oh, was that who it was? Who came to see us?
Adam Thorpe. Yeah, and this and it was in a beautiful old house.
Oh, yes. So what it was, it was a really old building. But before it had been sort of converted into a recording studio, it had been this amazing library or a sort of repository for recorded film and music. So there was a massive collection of VHS tapes. There was loads and loads of cine film reels. But in terms of music, there were wax cylinders. There were 78s, there were 45s, there were, everything you could think of. And loads of CDs. It went up to the world of CDs. But they had these lovely albums on the shelves that had a little loop of cord that you pulled down so you didn't trash the spine when you pulled it out the shelf. And these were blank, a lot of them. They had sleeves ready for you to put your records in that you got from the record shop. Usually it would have been in a blank sleeve. Yeah. And I was sort of fascinated by this because then, I've done a bit of a thing with my... in the past of doing ridiculously over-elaborate record packaging. So I kind of thought, well, I'll do that. I'll take this. So for the record they were doing then that became the Moonshaped Pool, I made a version of this album. It was like a photo album, the old bound volumes. Yeah. And even the ones you buy now, they still hark back to that kind of leather bound with a bit of gilding on, even though they're all plastic and that now.
But there's a period where it was just plain, and then someone recognised that this was a place where you can advertise the wares inside.
Yeah, and not just the wares inside. I've got some really old sleeves that have just got basically adverts on them. So they just, because it was blank paper, so you could advertise anything, corned beef, baked beans.
That would work, wouldn't it?
On the sleeve, yeah.
Yeah.
What would have been the first, insofar as we can pinpoint it, what would have been an early example, or the first person to put art rather than advertisements?
I have no idea.
What was the first one that you saw, Stanley, the way you thought, oh my God, that's an album cover?
I started buying records in the late 1970s, so it was whatever was, I think, you know, my first record was Two by Army. It was Our Friends Electric, you know, it was on Top of the Pops, and it was brilliant. And I don't know how old I was, about 11 or 12, 12 probably. And it was just great. It had this sort of a mysterious world of which I knew nothing.
Yeah.
And did you sort of buy it on the basis of what it looked like, though?
Not that one. I bought that on the basis of Top of the Pops.
Oh, okay. Like
the Thursday before.
But your argument in this is that you can judge a album by its cover. You can.
Yes, it's a very flimsy argument.
Stanley, make that flimsy argument now. Now, I want to hear this. I think that's because you think that covers are suggestive of styles.
Yeah.
So you could spot a progressive rock cover.
Exactly, yes. If there was sort of Roger Dean,
yeah.
Or there was several artists who excelled in sort of fantasy,
yeah.
Which is the sort of thing you get on a cover of something like Lord of the Rings or something like that.
Yeah.
And you knew that the music was going to be prog rock,
yeah.
You know, or if there was sort of sans serif fonts, and which I didn't even know that term then, minimal photography and a big stripe colour, probably going to be jazz.
Yeah.
You know, you just sort of know.
I was into metal when I was a kid, and heavy metal.
Oh, God, yeah.
The iconography of heavy metal, I mean, you know heavy metal straight away.
I met the bloke who invented that Eddie character, you know, the kind of...
In Iron Maiden?
Yeah.
So do you know about this theater? Yeah. Do you know Eddie?
Horrible.
Do you know how to do?
I do. Well, yeah. I went to university.
Yeah.
You can't avoid these things. There's always someone. I wasn't particularly into metal.
My whole family's into Iron Maiden, and I grew up listening to Iron Maiden.
Wow.
And the best thing about the records that they sold, not only were they were the amazing album cover, the Eddie album cover, the records themselves were shaped like Eddie's features. So instead of being circular, they were cut into the shape of the drawings.
Yeah, so that's amazing because that shows they cared considerably more about image than music quality.
And that would have been a lot of work.
Hang on, what are we saying here?
Well, this is something else I learned, is that picture discs, really bad sound quality.
Yeah, well, I can believe
because it's a bit of paper.
I thought you were criticising the musicianship of Iron Maiden for a second there.
I never dreamed of doing such a thing.
I want to hear about 20 Jazz Funk Greats by Throbbing Gristle.
Yeah.
Should we have heard of Throbbing? Thea, have you heard of
Throbbing Gristle? Of course, we even had I commissioned a piece about them.
When?
About a year, 2 years ago. Ben Easton wrote it.
Obviously hasn't read it.
No, I haven't read a paper.
Are you the editor of the TLS?
Anyway, tell us about Throbbing Gristle.
This is moving swiftly on.
Yeah, exactly. It's humiliating. Go on.
Well, Throbbing Gristle were... I heard one of their records on John Peel or something like that, you know, late at night listening to my little transistor radio.
Yeah.
And then I sort of, because of that, that's what I mean, it's sort of like music and the sleeves of records were a sort of gateway drug into all sorts of knowledge that I wouldn't have ever come across.
It's almost an education because there's cultural reference.
I said that because it's the really easy, oh dear, what an idiot I was. So I'd never heard of the Bauhaus, you know, as the art movement in Germany before the Second World War and everything it led to. So, you know, as everyone who listens to this or reads the TLS will know what the Bauhaus is and what influence it's had on everything from furniture to architecture and everything else in between. So I didn't know any of that, but there was a band called Bauhaus whose music I liked. I bought their records and realised that the design on the label of the records was a Bauhaus construction, and then went to the library and got out a book which was also called Bauhaus, which is a little black-spined sort of Thames and Hudson.
Yeah. Do you know what? We had a piece by a guy called DJ Taylor about The Jam, and he was saying that The Jam was a really good example of a band where people, inside it were autodidacts, and they'd basically gone, they had libraries, they went to libraries, and you got references, deliberate references to Auden or someone like that. Mm. And not only were they showing that they educated themselves, they left a legacy of people who would have found a reference and thought, well, what's that? And then gone off and found it.
This is sort of, I think that you can kind of trace this dissemination of knowledge, because like universities used to be the repositories of knowledge and you had to go to university to learn anything really properly clever, but you could only go there if you were really rich and went to a private school. But then they democratized university education and all these grammar school boys and girls went to uni, and then people like Ridley Scott, for example, or David Bailey, for example, people who come from a non-posh background and then they have access to culture and knowledge and that spreads. And then that spreads even further out into popular culture and you get it on the sleeve of a 45 record. in a shop in Essex and I can go and buy it and learn all about Mies van der Rohe and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Something in particular about coming across art on a record sleeve, it sort of reminds me a bit of skateboard culture as well, how you can kind of come across art and music and literary references in a particular context that is, it's not top-down, and it's almost like the art and these references are secondary to this other thing which you know you love. Yeah. So there's something non-threatening about it, and it's democratic, and it's up to you whether you follow up on them, yes. And you don't know that they have already been judged to be good by someone else who knows.
Like you say about skateboard culture, it's I think each generation has its own way in, and it has to be something that the old people, your olds, don't get.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, they don't understand what it is. What do you see in that?
Exactly. You know? And that's what's so cool, sorry, about the way you're talking about record sleeve art, is that it was designed for young people by young people. Mm. Yeah. So there's a real sense of...
Yeah, you make the point that the democracy actually goes in all directions because no one knew the value of it. They let untried people have a pop at it.
Yeah.
So it gave them. Exactly. And you've done. How many record sleeves have you done for Radiohead?
Early 90s?
I don't know, to be honest.
A lot.
Many.
What's the track?
Radiohead, and indeed, I mean, I think all music to then turn it into an artistic representation is very hard. How do you go about designing a cover for Radiohead? Do you.
It sort of differs from time to time. It's in many ways that I don't really have to do very much because it's there. In the music,
and you're there at the recording.
Yeah,
that's kind of interesting, isn't it? That when they go off to their lovely chateau in France to record, you're there.
That was only the once. Normally, it's a sort of decrepit, horrible, haunted. man.
But you are there. Are you there? But you're there as part of the process.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
And what are you doing while you're there? Then are you soaking it up and then?
Yeah, I guess normally I kind of normally have some ideas that I want to express, and the plan normally is that I will use the media of Radiohead's record covers to get my ideas out to the general public, but that doesn't really work. and while I'm there, that you listen to the music, and then I kind of find that the music draws its artwork itself, and really it's fishing for it and trying to catch what it is.
And they're quite a collaborative bunch. I mean, like I said, this interview that I read, they seem like quite a nice collaborative bunch.
It's slightly like a religious retreat or something. So everyone, you know, we kind of meet at meal times and talk and stuff like that, and everyone goes off and does their own things, or sometimes come together, and it's like being in a nunnery. We're a bunch of nuns, really.
A rock and roll nunnery.
Rock and roll nunnery.
Should we be depressed, Stanley? Because you end on a slightly low note, which is. I pretty much listen to most of my music on Spotify now.
Ah. It's quite good, though, the online music, I think, because I'm finding loads of music that I'd never have heard of.
Even more than when you're in a record shop, because I was thinking about the point the Theo was making about discovery.
Oh, man, record shops are even worse than they were than when I was young now. I'm even really intimidated. Because I've missed the point.
Now.
Well, when I was young, I didn't think I was cool enough because everyone was a bit older than me. I'm really cool in the record shop. And now, like, time's just really passed. And now I'm like, kind of like that granddad character. I record for my gramophone. Yeah. You know, that sort of thing.
Are they a crazy hipster place now? I bet they are.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I probably would have become a hipster if I was cool enough or young enough.
You are a hipster.
Am I?
Yeah, of course you're a hipster.
Oh, man.
What's that?
What is a hipster?
Stanley's a hipster.
No, what is a hipster?
I don't know.
This isn't helpful.
No. The record shop when I was growing up in Loughborough was called...
I'm glad you're here, otherwise we would just go on and on and on about all sorts of things.
What? But,
well, no, I mean, I'm also... I live in a relatively small town. We have two record shops, and neither of them are even remotely intimidating.
Really?
They're not intimidating places.
The place I went with as a kid was a place called the Left Legged Pineapple, and it was more of a... That was the name of the shop. But it was more of a CD shop. I was there, and... But even then, I remember going through CD racks.
And make a different noise, clap.
Yeah, exactly. That was a play. I mean, we're now we're old. We're the worst. We're kind of nostalgic hipsters here, aren't we?
Yeah, not that kind of flap.
Yeah. But do you think the artwork suffered digitally? Is that an argument?
Well, by the time I started making records, which was about 1994, it was already CDs. There was vinyl. Because I remember the first, before we did anything, me and Tom went into... some shop in Oxford High Street, like HMV or one of the big ones, and they have high ceilings, a great big wall covered in 12-inch records. And we was like, right, so we've got to do something better than all of those. And we're like, how did they do it? I was like, most of them got faces on them. They've got the faces of the singer. We can't have that. So because we haven't done that yet.
You've not done the faces?
Done their faces.
So is this before, was it Pablo Honey? Was it the first one?
No, I didn't do that one.
Which one? What was your first one?
First one was a single, but from the Bends. So I did the Bends.
You did the Bends. Mm. And so did you know you had to do something big? Were you feeling like this had to be a statement that you had to do when you...
Oh, God, I didn't know. I was only about 24 or something. I don't, yeah. 25? I don't know. At the time, I wasn't really interested in anything in particular. I think I'd wanted to do artwork. I didn't really want to do art.
But
I just
did it
by a mistake.
Did you find yourself ever feeling frustrated that it wasn't on a wall?
Like a painting?
Yeah, I mean, all of the artwork that you'd done, these beautiful things that you'd created, did you ever feel slightly like you wanted it to be on a wall rather than, you know, if you think of a record shop, you could only, unless you pulled it out, you'd only see kind of two-thirds of it.
Unless they sold loads and then
put it on the wall.
Yeah, not really, no, because the first time I saw the Bends in a record shop, I think it came out and we were in Nottingham or somewhere. I went into a record shop because I was like, I wonder if it's out. And I was up there next to Paul Weller record, actually, Stanley Road, that Peter Blake had done. I was right next to Peter Blake.
Wow.
And to be honest, it's better than being on a wall. That was just like...
Yeah, you made
it. And that's where all this stuff about it being a democratic art gallery, that's kind of where my kind of thinking about that came from, was just like, oh, wow, look, so there's no hierarchy in the shop. Well, there is. Depends on who sells the most records, but
which is a kind of meritocracy in some ways.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah.
We could talk about this for ages, but we better leave it there. Stanley Donwell, thank you so much for coming in.
That's absolutely fine. Thank you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Charlotte Perriand, the designer and architect, and we'll talk about why the words should go that way round in a moment, was born in Paris in 1903 and died also in Paris 96 years later. There's a neat loop to her life, which spanned the whole of the 20th century, and her career, which, in a way, Keith Miller suggests this week, circles back to a simple choker necklace made of ball bearings, first conceived while a student in the mid-1920s. But don't let this idea of neatness fool you into thinking there weren't many phases to Perriand's creation, which moved from the luxe industriel, lots of steel and pony skin, to cheapish prefabs made of plywood, and the nature-led projects of the 1950s and 60s, most famously a mountain township near the French border with Switzerland. For those unfamiliar with Perriand's work, by the way, I highly recommend Google imaging it, or some other search engine, and you might spend a pleasant hour imagining a new life for yourself, as I did.
Don't say that, dear.
It's amazing. Yeah. I went down such a rabbit hole. I mean, yes. Anyway, Keith Miller has read four volumes by Jacques Barsac on Perriand's complete works, and he joins us in the studio to tell us more now. Hello, Keith.
Hello.
Well, it's difficult to know quite how to pitch a piece on Perriand, I think, because it's not necessarily a question of remembering this forgotten or neglected figure, because she's not really either of those two things.
No, and I think, you know, she's responsible, or collectively responsible with a team of other designers for a very, very sort of canonical, high modernist look. She made furniture, but she also kind of orchestrated interiors for a number of Le Corbusier's projects before and after the war. And then the stuff she did on her own later on is a very sort of distinctive, kind of chunky mid-century aesthetic.
But is she well known? I mean, it may just be my own ignorance, but this didn't feel like a figure
Well, it's kind of fair to say that people will know Le Corbusier and Jean Prouvé and people who she worked with more.
I agree with that.
I think they don't know Prouvé as well as they should, to be honest. But people who are at all interested in 20th century design will know of her. And there's also been a slightly kind of dialectical thing where her reputation was not rebuilt, it never completely went away. But there was a whole issue about the authorship of some of the furniture designs from the late 20s, which were reissued in 1959. And for possibly sound commercial reasons, she was slightly sort of airbrushed out of the picture at that stage.
In favour of Le Corbusier?
Yeah, in fact, well, Le Corbusier sort of owned the kind of overall intellectual property, I think, and he did split the royalties with his cousin Pierre Jeanneret and with Perrion, but they went out kind of under his mark.
I bet that happened quite a lot in all, because it happened with Fitzgerald, sure. Didn't it? That Zelda wrote articles and F. Scott
put his name to them,
and that was because that was the way of monetizing it better as a thing.
Yeah, and obviously there's a kind of gender dimension to that as well. I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, Le Corbusier was a bit, are we allowed to say bastard? He was a bit of a bastard in lots of ways. He was a little bit of a fascist in some ways and a challenging man. But he did sort of orchestrate this group of very talented people whose talents he kind of acknowledged and didn't quite exploit, but he placed them under the overall umbrella of his kind of style. He talked about a force creative, I think, as a thing that he had, that all the sort of individuals working in his atelier, both before the war and after the war, didn't have, although they were very good at chairs or they were very good at kind of walls or, you know, whatever they were good at.
Is it wrong to say that he, because it's always, it now correctly feels a bit odd every time you find a sort of female artist to sort of trace this influence in her life as this dominant male, but is that probably true in the sense of Corbusier? Did he shape her the way she created things?
I think it's really hard to tell. I mean, the development. I've got a proof of the page in front of me, and there's a very celebrated set of images where she, as it were, modelled on this sort of chaise longue, which is made of two arcs of tubular steel with a sort of sinuous bit that you recline on top of it. And it's very, very sort of recognisable, canonical, modernist thing. And you know, the drawings for that are in her hand. So I think a lot of the kind of credit for devising that goes to her. However, there are broadly similar things in different materials that quite a lot of people are producing. You know, this is a sort of zeitgeist thing. So even beyond Le Corbusier's atelier and the question of whether he dominated that in an unhealthy way or a chauvinistic way, there was this sort of sense of fellow travellers, I think, at the time. I mentioned in my piece that there's a sort of device that Perrion uses in a very elegant armchair, which is clearly sort of pinched, basically, from Marcel Breuer, who's one of the people at the Bauhaus just a couple of years earlier. So there's a lot of kind of cross currents in a lot of different directions. And, you know, the fact, if you like, the sort of scandal is that there's only one Charlotte Perrion, so we can't infer too much from her case because there aren't enough women working in the industry for us to sort of see patterns. And she herself seems to have been incredibly sort of reticent about being viewed as a kind of, you know, a woman designer. She wanted her sort of private life kept out of the office. She sort of demurred when sometimes attempts were made to kind of flatter her as a sort of,
you know, wonder whether she must
automatically
have
understood kind of the nurturing side of domestic design. And she sort of responds to comments like that with just a sort of dignified silence, really. So I would, on the basis of quite a sort of scant engagement, I wouldn't want to put her gender at the forefront of her career, really.
And yet you get the sense that she probably would have bristled slightly, at least, at being asked to model her own work in a way that probably one of her contemporaries wouldn't have.
I don't know about the context of this. I mean, I think these poses, and they are very, there's something kind of voluptuous about them, because the chrome steel, the curvy bit, sits on top of a steel frame, and it moves very freely, so you can have your legs up in the air or your head up in the air. It's a very sort of elegant, simple.
And are these designed? I never quite know with these things. How much are these designed practically, and how much are they designed? Because we have a piece by Joyce Carol Oates talks about Frank Lloyd Wright and his idea of buildings being organic. They really are to be lived in. When we're talking about high modernism and furniture, And even when you talk about Bauhaus, actually, it feels to me we're talking about stuff that's designed to be looked at and would be a bit uncomfortable to sit on.
Yeah, it's too perfect. But, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, my partner has, and I now occasionally sit in, a cheapo copy of Charlotte Perriand's Shares, and it's too small for me.
Yeah, well, you're a big lad, though, Keith.
But it's like a normal sofa. You know, a Habitat sofa isn't too small for me because I can adjust myself on it, whereas this is very rigid in terms of, you know, you can put your legs up in the air, but your bum's got to go in a particular place. So there is this sort of... It's another of these slightly sort of lazy critical discourses around modernism, that it's too rigid and that the human imperfections are sort of never... And I think, you know, actually, like somebody like Le Corbusier, who's, you know, and we know a lot about what Le Corbusier thought he was doing because he wrote a lot, and he wrote a lot of kind of polemic, and he wrote very beautifully, he wrote a lot of... I think he has got this sort of sense of high art, and there's a point at which kind of functionalism is elevated, and he actually only uses the term architecture very sparingly to talk about the correct and magnificent play of forms in light or something, and he sees it as a sort of an aesthetic realm that's slightly over and above the more utilitarian consideration. And that feeds down, like Perriand talks about liberating materials that she's using in the late 20s from the ghetto of hospitals and schools and sort of industrial institutions.
Where they're actually being used.
Where they're actually being used in a much more kind of workaday way. And you know, there's loads of tubular steel furniture starting to happen because the technology for extruding it and producing it is just coming online.
And did her... I mean, you mentioned Le Corbusier's politics before. Her politics clearly influenced her work. Is it fair to say that it increasingly influenced it as she found her own feet and became more of a designer in her own right?
I think it's increasingly led to sort of tensions with Le Corbusier. It's a slight sort of calumny to call him a fascist, but he does, you know, that he does occasionally use anti-Semitic language. One of his friends was a fascist. It's partly about the very complicated politics of France during the war years. I mean, you know, he did go to Vichy France and he did try and get commissions from it, and then he came back to Paris. And after the war, he became a kind of great... apostle for you know, the better future and a rebuilt world that was going to be more egalitarian. So, but she, I think, is just very strongly socialist. She thought very seriously about going to live in Russia for a while in the 1930s, and she continued to hold those beliefs as far as one can tell. But yes, you know, her biggest architectural commission is designing a ski resort, and I'm not sure how socialist that is. Really.
Yeah, I think there was a private commission for the Maharaja. Yeah.
Were her politics divorced from her designs? I mean, is there anything you can do to link the two together? Maybe not.
Well, you know, Keir Hardie said nothing is too good for the working classes. He was spotted dining at the Savoy, and actually there's no reason not to do any particular gig you get as well as you can possibly do it, I suppose. Yeah. And also, you know, I think through Perriand worked with this guy Jean Prouvé, who was a great pioneer of mass production, and he actually started to think about how you could use the techniques of industrialization to roll out all the brilliant ideas that everyone had been having in the 20s and 30s. Le Corbusier at that point was also thinking more about kind of mass, or more pragmatically maybe about mass housing. He'd done a lot of very utopian, very drastic schemes before the war, but after the war there are these things called the Unité d'habitation, which are like a kind of one-size-fits-all, very ingenious, not unproblematic, but kind of magnificent.
The first time you sort of have that sense, which we're quite familiar with now, of sort of high couture having a sort of high street, real-world application. So you might have things that are done at the highest end, but there is a clear pathway from that to mass production and general usage.
A number of factors come together after the war, one of which is the war, so you need to rebuild a lot because a lot of stuff's been flattened. And there's a sort of slow advance of technology, and it all kind of comes together. And you know, suddenly a lot of the paper dreams of kind of 20s and 30s do turn into reality. And then, of course, they become events in the real world, and they become the subjects of kind of backlash and different kinds of discourse, you know, the sort of Prince Charles kind of...
Walls are breaking down, aren't they? And you know, social mobility is increased, and the ability of things to mingle and merge seems to be increased after the war, very obviously, because all sorts of...
Potentially. I mean, I think there's a sort of... You know, this is a very glib sort of oversimplification of mine, but I think there's a way in which... in France and in the Netherlands and in Germany, actually, that the sort of bourgeoisie embraced modernism before the war. And, for example, a lot of refugees from Nazism brought their Bauhaus furniture with them, whether it was to New York or Tel Aviv or London, you know. So they're kind of individual vectors for a set of ideas. And they themselves kind of take up maybe slightly more influential social positions in the normal run of the progress through their own lives and their own careers. Partly just the ideas kind of take a while to bed in, I think.
She wasn't in Europe during the Second World War, or she wasn't by the time the Nazis rolled into Paris. She was in Japan.
Yeah, she was on a kind of design quango, basically. She was there for a sort of French kind of design organisation to look at Japanese design. And she was already interested in it, and as were a lot of the modernists, the idea of purity and the idea of the aestheticization of everyday life. Obviously, that's really embedded in Japanese culture, you know. And then she was interned, and she had to spend a couple of years in Vietnam, which is where she met her second husband, I think, possibly already in Japan, anyway. But that continued to be very influential. A lot of her sort of furniture from the 50s and 60s is quite Japanese-looking.
Yeah, she found a sort of, well, tradition being new, a way of bringing the two supposedly opposing things together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, slightly avant la lettre, she seems to have got more interested in sustainability as well. I mean, you know, that's a very sort of happening word now, but it's not a great insult to her to say that she wasn't particularly interested in the craft herself. She wasn't sort of, I mean, she designs very tactile objects, but then other people tend to make them.
It's that she's kind of right. I mean, I know you don't think she needs to be rediscovered, but she's kind of feels slightly ripe for rediscovery or more broad discovery, don't you think?
I would think so.
Why did you lose yourself? I still what part of it?
Oh, I just, it's that whole period of kind of 1950s architecture when Jean Prouvé was working on his kind of big unité d'habitation that you were talking about, that sort of style. I love it so much. It's just my ideal, with the kind of the use of wood on the outsides and all of these cheap fabrics and the fact that they would commission these spaces with a real sense of the space that a human needed to live well.
Yeah.
Not just to exist, to live well.
Sometimes a lot of the designs from the 20s and 30s are slightly kind of monastic, except for these big, very expensive villas.
And really thinking about where they were building them. So if you look at Perriand's things, buildings, the township that she built in the Haute-Savoie, you've got the use of glass that reflects the hill, the mountains, so that the space, they absorb each other in a way that you wouldn't necessarily think, oh, you know, really modernist architecture is going to look terrible on a beautiful alpine mountainside. But it doesn't.
And the roofs of at least one of the blocks do a sort of zigzag, so they're actually mirroring the form of the mountain.
Well, so that's why.
All right, well, so I'm going to go off and Google it. Everyone listening should go off and Google it. Keith Miller, thank you so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Emily Bernhard Jackson, Stanley Donwood and Keith Miller. Do have a look at our design issue of the TLS and read at least these two pieces as well as what you've heard on the podcast. Joyce Carol Oates does Frank Lloyd Wright, and there is just an extraordinary piece of writing about the layout of Auschwitz by Nikolaus Waxman. That's one of the best things I've read about that terrible place. Next week, we are in the realm of science fiction, Thea. And I was going to say Lucy Dallas is going to come in and guide us, but she's not around.
She's going to be in space.
She's written a piece arguing for one of her crazy sci-fi things that
we've talked
about
opera.
On this podcast. Yep. We made a deal, I think, as a result of this podcast, potentially.
I think possibly, yeah.
But she's not going to be here. So we'll have to find some other people. Where are you on science fiction? Knowledgeable?
Not really, no.
So we'll be the
useful
idiots.
We'll find someone who is.
We'll be the useful idiots, as ever. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.